The Golden Age. A View in Hindsight. On the 12th of February 1930, a nurse and trained pilot called Ellen Church visited Stephen Stimson, one of the managers at Boeing, with a proposal. Perhaps women could be of use during cabin service. The idea was audacious. Women looking after people and being paid for it. How would they fit their hips through the aisles? If the plane was in trouble, would the pilot really have time to come out of the cockpit to staunch their tears? But Church wisely suggested that these women would be no ordinary useless women. They would be trained nurses, superwomen hardened at the sharp end of a scalpel. The whole thing sounded dubious, but Stimson saw a way of packaging the deal. It was a different path to his previous idea of exclusively using young Filipino males, but maybe it could work. Like all true men of action, he immediately wrote a memo. It strikes me that there would be great psychological punch to have young women stewardesses. Imagine the national publicity we could get from it, and the tremendous effect it would have on the travelling public. What strikes me is, when did Ellen Church say anything about the stewardesses being young? Sure, they can nurse, Dempsey. They can nurse like gangbusters. But the thing I want to stress is how immature some of these dames are. They're barely out of their teens. Keep talking. You know how when you're in danger, the only person who can reassure you is a really young female? Keep talking. So you've just lost an arm. You're super bummed about it. But you look up and a 19-year-old is applying the tourniquet. You're passing out from the pain, but look how smooth her skin is. Is she pretty, Ellen? She is, Stimps. She's real pretty. You don't even know how pretty she is. I never liked that stupid arm anyway. Stimson managed to persuade Boeing's board to go with the idea, but only if the nurses weren't so young that their tits hadn't had a chance to grow. Within a few years, the need for nursing qualifications was dropped, youth, tailored uniforms and attractiveness being deemed more than sufficient replacements for the ability to save lives. The airlines were faced with a catch-22. They sought to comfort those frightened of flying by providing cabin crew to help with safety, but they had to make it clear that the cabin crew weren't really needed for safety because the planes were already so massively safe. Thus, the stewardesses came to be presented as merely decorative. They were receptionists without the administrative burden, maids without the elbow room. If women weren't afraid to be on a plane, why should anyone else be? Plus, if a woman were forced to share the same contained space as you, an emotionally closed-off businessman, how would she stop herself falling in love? Had she any idea how many moves you have? Had she any idea how many women would fall prey to your charms if only they were employed to pretend to like you? Flying was like a cocktail party, where the guests were so magnanimous that they invited the staff to sit with them a little while. After the end of World War II, with much of the female workforce displaced by returning soldiers, women found their employment options limited. The application rate for stewardesses was huge. Several thousand applicants would compete for a score of jobs, and the airlines rightly filtered out the unsightly. Becoming a stewardess allowed women to take on a role that was uniquely feminine, a blank canvas onto which men could project their desire. But these women weren't just sexually objectified, they were also forced to conform to a male idea of female elegance. Stewardesses had to dress the same, have their hair cut the same way, and walk as if they were miming being a teapot. It is to these times that Sally Weston wishes to return. Here is a woman who pines for a time when people dressed up for air travel instead of wearing flip-flops and a t-shirt saying, "I'm allergic to mornings." A time when stewardesses were grounded at the age of 32 for being past their best, both in terms of looks and temperament. By then, their faces would begin to sag, and businessmen would not be able to fantasize about having intercourse with them without reflecting wistfully on the tragic cruelty of a beauty that fades. Weston yearns for a time when there wasn't a single non-Caucasian stewardess in the whole of North America. A time when Aloha Airlines flight attendants were required to hula hoop and play the ukulele. A time when a stewardess could weigh no more than 115 pounds lest she destabilise the plane. a time when an applicant for the job of stewardess would be asked to let the airline know she had disproportionately large feet so that they could save both parties the disappointment of an interview. A time when a stewardess could not be married for fear that the guilt caused by her absence from her husband's side would render her unable to concentrate. A time when you could not be a stewardess and have visible scars, even though all scars, by definition, are visible. A time when, owing to the rules about being single, non-pregnant and in your 20s, there was no prospect of increased pay or advancement, the job being a prelude to the domesticity for which it was a de facto training ground. An elegant time. A better time. There is still an unpleasant elephant in the walk-in wardrobe, and that is a question of where all this leads. Sally Weston tells Donna to never let go of her dream. However, the Sally Weston plan only works if your dream is to be an air stewardess and never ask the question, and then what? If your dream is to see Paris, but only in very short bursts, or to hear the word playfulness used to justify sexual harassment, then those dreams can absolutely work under the umbrella of the primary becoming an air stewardess dream, but that's about it. The implication seems to be that, by dint of her focus in the aisles, Sally Weston has acquired all of this wealth. But her wages alone could not buy a really big house. And although Sally's book seems like an absolute banger, it's only just been published. Those royalties take a while to trickle through, believe me. Like Sally, Donna's main chance of wealth is to meet and marry a wealthy person. Thus, the stewardess is a debutante who has to do her own catering and clean up after the guests depart. How will Donna meet this wealthy person? There is always a chance that someone flying in first class might not be despicable. There's a chance that such a person isn't horrendous and spoilt. There might be a genuine mutual attraction. And there's a chance that that attraction might be free from the dangerous corrosion of the attendant power imbalance. It's very possible that a good relationship can spring up between a wealthy older man and a younger woman who has to bring him refreshments whenever he presses a button. That's what happened with Sally Weston and the leathery, homophobic, grunting love of her life. But even if this were possible, Donna has already met Ted. Donna's not going to get rich like Sally Weston did, because Donna's not going to marry a man who is already rich. Perhaps Ted can become rich, but that's not going to happen anytime soon. And in the meantime, no one ever got rich handing out complimentary ramekins of hot nuts. In her seminal survey of the stewardess, Femininity in Flight, A History of Flight Attendants, author Kathleen M. Barry brings her story to a close in the 70s. Confining the post-70s era to the briefest of epilogues, the implication being that by the time Jimmy Carter signed the 1978 Airline Deregulation Act, the golden age of air travel was over. Certainly, this is Sally Weston's view. So why is she recommending that Donna enter a profession so clearly in decline?